This is an RNZ podcast.
Nā iwi o te mōtō, tēnā koutou katoa. It's great to have your company for Country Life. I'm Carol Stiles.
And I'm Duncan Smith. Kia ora. Today, we have a story from our 90s file. We meet a young grower who has a job that allows him to pop to the beach to cool off at lunchtime.
We're in Gisborne with a man who makes dog kennels and runs for farmers. He also churns out dunnies.
Later on in the program, we visit a farm-based wool carding business in central Otago that produces fibre for spinning.
But first to our look at conditions on the land. It's still very dry in Northland. Farmers are really hoping the rain will come as they have quite a few cattle to get to the works and need to shut up paddocks for baleage. There is a big moisture deficit and with coolish nights still, they really need some warmer, wetter weather to get into gear. Around Pukekohe, sufficient rain should have fallen over most of the district, meaning there's been no need for irrigation this week. Days have been calm and mild, and crops are looking good. It's been a farmer's dream in Waikato, a little rain followed by some warm, sunny days. Pasture growth rates are good, but the ground's still fairly dry. Maize is going in and turnips are being sown. Where there's surplus grass, silage is being harvested. While the recent rise in Fonterra's forecast payout is giving farmers confidence, they have learned to be cautious about what they do with the cash. There's growing interest in changing land use, with some smaller farms looking at options in horticulture and sheep milking.
In King Country, it's been amazing spraying and growing weather. Docking's nearly finished on a hill country farm, and some early lambs are starting to go off to the works. A lot of fresh feed around has encouraged worms, and a contact says among cattle especially, the worm burden is quite high. Some farmers are struggling with not enough roughage because of the drought last year, so cattle are going down with either bloat or worm issues. Early silage is being cut. We're told a number of beautiful farms in the area have come up for sale. A kiwi fruit grower in Bay of Plenty was waiting for a batch of pollen to be dropped off when we rang. It's harvested during the last season, put in freezers over the summer, and at $5,000 a kilo, it's not cheap. The whole pollination process is about to kick off. Bees are starting to go into the early gold orchards now, and the Hayward or green variety in a couple of weeks' time. Pasture is looking good on dairy farms, but there's only just enough rain falling, 23 millimetres in the gauge this morning. If you dig down 30 centimetres, it's dry.
A misty light rain was falling in Taranaki on Friday morning. It's been warmer this week and grass is at peak growth. Dairy farmers are making silage and mating is in full swing. Rainfall's been about average and milk production is 3 or 4% ahead of last year. A farmer in Manawatū says after a little bit of rain earlier in the week, everything's bolting and the tractors are humming. It's amazing what a couple of days of sunshine can do. He's getting his lucerne planted and some summer brassicas in as an insurance policy for the expected dry summer. Today his rams are being palpated in readiness for selling. The ram's testicles need to be checked for defects to determine soundness for breeding. On top of all that, there's a new baby at home.
The Gisborne region is at a bit more welcome rain in isolated areas after about 40 to 80 millimetres last week. But much more regular rain is needed to make farmers feel comfortable. Most of the docking's finished apart from on high country farms. Cropping-wise, maize is in. It's been a very mixed spring and a wine grower is counting the cost of frost. 10 to 20% of his Chardonnay crop has suffered damage and he's never spent so much on helicopter protection. Hawke's Bay has been really dry, but there was a nice dollop of rain this week, 40 to 50 millimetres on the Hiratonga Plains, one of the country's largest fruit production areas. It couldn't have come at a better time for fruit crops. The warmth this spring also bodes well for fruit taste and size. Despite efforts to bring more Kiwi labour into the orchard and pack houses, the lack of overseas backpackers and doubt over a seasonal labour force out of the Pacific is still worrying growers.
A Wairarapa vineyard owner has been busy bud rubbing and shoot thinning in the vines. The region has had some cracker fine days. Soil temperatures are starting to sneak up and dry ridges on farms are starting to become evident. People are beginning to switch on irrigators and rain would be welcome. There have been ideal ground conditions for establishing crops and contractors are hard out in their big machines taking advantage of the good weather. Drivers just have to be patient if they're behind them on rural roads. A pea crop grower is excited the first crop in 4 years has gone in this week. Eradicating the pea weevil has been a success story for the region, which is a big pea cropping area. The seed produced eventually finds its way to peas on the Christmas dinner table.
The Tasman region had a good rain 3 days ago, between 50 and 70 millimetres. Our contact says it went to a good home. He was doing the last of his tailing today. He doesn't know his lambing percentage yet, but he says everyone's scanning results were back after the drought, so numbers have to be down. The crayfisher we spoke to in Marlborough says once the Chinese lobster market opened up again in late April, the season's been okay, a bit up and down, and prices are back a bit, but at least it's functioning. He says the week's been warm, around 22 degree days, and recreational fishers will be gearing up for a great weekend on the water because the forecast is pretty stable. There's almost no wind up near the Sounds.
It's still extremely wet on the whole of the west coast, although thankfully the past 2 days have been fine. Farmers are still waiting for the paddocks to dry out enough to plant next winter's crops and are saying so much for the government's earlier plan that winter crop planting needed to be done by October the 1st in Westland. Farmers want those paddocks planted. They don't want bare land, but the weather is boss. The milking peak has come and gone and our southern Westland farmer says it wasn't very high. Mating is due to start in a week and not many cows are cycling. We didn't end that call feeling too cheerful. It was another cool, dry week in Canterbury with a few late frosts impacting on grass growth. On the whole, dairy farmers are feeding out as they wait for the spring flush. With feed being tight, store stock are hard to move and prices are easing. And dry conditions in central and northern Canterbury have continued to intensify over the past week. NIWA's latest hotspot report shows the most significant soil moisture decreases occurred in Banks Peninsula. Hotspots, a term NIWA uses to describe areas that are severely drier than normal, can be found in southern Canterbury as well as near Christchurch and in Selwyn's coastal district.
In the Mackenzie Basin near Twisel, lambing is well underway and the past 10 days have brought great weather. Crossbreed ewes are finished, but merinos have another week to 10 days. The farmer we spoke to has spent the last 5 days sitting in the tractor drilling 300 hectares of oats for the winter. Calving will come to an end soon, by about November the 4th, and the survival rate's about 98%, which, given the recent cold blasts, it's a really good result. Things are ticking along okay in Otago and Southland. Grass is slowly starting to grow. It's been a cold, typical October. Temperatures are only just creeping up. It's been wet, so getting crops in the ground has been very slow. Our farmer here also says if the government rulings around planting had stayed in place, most farmers would have been breaking the rule, which said they needed to be completed by November the 1st. He says there's no way ground conditions would have let him meet that target.
You're listening to Country Life on RNZ National, 101 FM.
We have a story from our 90s file now, where we speak to people under 30 who have chosen a career on the land, or related to it, and ask them why. Today, Carol's with last year's Gisborne Tairawhiti Young Fruit Grower of the Year.
I'm Sam Teachin. I'm born in 1993 and I'm currently working with the family on the family orchard in Gisborne.
It's not what you were doing a few years ago. You were doing engineering in Dunedin.
Yes, I actually studied engineering in Dunedin, yeah, mechanical. And I was working in the industry for a few years up in Auckland before I went overseas and sort of came back and did a grape harvest for a harvesting crew and then naturally sort of fitted back into the operation. And yeah, it's been good.
Were you always intending to come back onto the orchard?
I really wasn't sure, actually. I was going to see how engineering was going, and I was enjoying it. But yeah, being out in the open was really appealing to me when I came back. So, and not being restricted to the 9 to 5. I mean, you've got flexibility through the day, and you can sort of catch, do bits and pieces, work later or work start earlier, and you know, it's just a little more flexible.
What do you grow here?
So we've got citrus and grapes, and we're just about to do we are midway through a sort of a 5-hectare avocado development. Citrus, we've got lemons, a lot go to export, Japan, America and Russia, China.
Russia?
Yeah, Russia. We've got oranges and some mandarins, and Pinot Gris, Chardonnay and Sauvignon Blanc.
The avocados, that's something new for you.
Yeah, so that was sort of part of the reason I moved back, to try and add a bit of value and develop some bare land. So we've got a 5-hectare avocado development going in, hopefully be planting in the next 6 weeks, so that's fairly exciting.
What sort of avocados are you planting?
So we've got Hass, which is sort of where everyone sees in the supermarket, about 40% of that, and 40% of our neighbours propagated a couple of varieties, or one variety that we're putting mainly in, called Eclipse, which is a bigger green skin with a small pip, and it's buttery and a lot nicer than the Hass. So hoping to be the premium sort of avocado, so we're having a bit of a punt on that and seeing how we get on. And then we've got two other small little trial blocks. Yeah.
So you've been back on the farm how long now?
So been back almost 2 years.
Are you going to stay?
Yeah, I'd like to see it grow to a sort of the next level, and then maybe I can do more of a management site role and not be so hands-on, but it'd be good to see where we can take it.
And how's it been working with your dad? How's that transition been?
It's actually been really good. I mean, luckily we're at a size where we've got the citrus and the grapes, and sort of we can just both do our own thing and sort of run each sort of area individually, which has been really good, and we've both there to help each other when we need it, so works really well. And then I've been doing the avocado development, so yeah, we've sort of got our own areas which we look after, so we're not standing on each other all the time. Yeah, I don't know how Dad did it by himself for how many years.
Did you kind of have a handle on what needed to be done when you came back to work here properly?
Yeah, I'd always done the odd job here and there, or helped on the holidays and stuff like that, but I didn't actually understand how much there was to the whole process. I mean, I thought, come back and it'd be easy, but there's actually been a lot of learning, and it's taken sort of a good year to really, or a whole season really, to half understand everything and sort of work out how to proceed. Charlotte's a bit of a ditch here.
Yeah, okay, that's right.
These are my father's forte. He's been growing grapes for, 30 or 35 years. He planted these grapes when he was my age, so I sort of leave him to it. We contract grow for the likes of Villa Maria, and there's a Gisborne co-op called Gisborne who we supply a lot of the Sauvignon Blanc to.
What does Gisborne do with it?
So Gisborne, they've started this new program where they're they're filling up these containers with these, you know, like the old wine goon cardboard box. They're putting one of those goon sacks into a big 20-foot container, filling that with wine and shipping it off to Europe or UK, which they're bottling it and putting their label on it and calling it New Zealand or Gisborne Sauvignon Blanc. And they're having huge success with that, so that's exciting moving forward.
Have you tried the wine?
Yeah, we've tried it. We have sort of grower evenings a couple of times a year, which is, it's always good fun.
Yeah, and?
And it's good. Well, we enjoy it, yeah.
What is it about working in horticulture that you like?
Well, look at this. We're standing out and there's trees and growth all around us, and I don't know, it's grounding and interesting and exciting. Everyone's really friendly in the industry. Everyone's helpful, and even the older guys are happy to sort of give their knowledge and willing to help, especially young people. And climate's really good, and on a really hot day we'd pack a lunch and go have lunch at the beach, so that's quite cool.
In the middle of a work day?
12 to 1-ish lunchtime.
How far away is the beach?
It'd be less than 5 minutes, so quite close and easy. And it's always nice, yeah.
Do you get to use your mechanical engineering skills on the orchard?
I really enjoy like the problem-solving side of things, and like trying to find a new way of doing something. Like building up new bits and pieces that can sort of make jobs easier. So yeah, have a bit of fun with that. Came up with a few little ways to spread organic fertiliser, which I was pretty pleased about, and sort of build up frames for hedge cutters and stuff like that.
Are you organic here?
No, we're not organic, but I'm trying to sort of use a few more organic principles wherever I can. And also we've got one block which we've just planted in lemons, which I'm having a crack at, making organic from the start. It's quite hard to convert a block or a lemon block to organic, because you've got those sort of, it takes 3 years to convert, and then you've sort of got that period where your fruit's not organic, but it's not conventional, not clean enough for the market, but it's not organic, so can't really, sort of an awkward place. So yeah, it's going to be really exciting to see if I can get this block and get it looking good and keep it organic. I'm not going to say I'm 100%, we're 100% organic, because we're not, but I lean more trying to do the organic way of things if possible.
What does Dad think about that?
He's pretty old school. Not much really.
Fruit grower Sam Teachin from Gisborne.
Now, we've heard from Margot Saunders about one of our stories last week with farmer Peter Bloom. She says, I'm on the side of the animal rights campaigners regarding the factory farming of pigs. It was disturbing to listen to and confirmed my worst fears about the intensive farming of pigs. For a sow to produce 36 piglets a year is a gross violation of animal welfare standards. And if pig farmers are unable to cope with the mud and hard work of farming their pigs outside, then they should not be pig farming at all. Your interviewer could have been much more challenging when talking to Mr. Bloom about these matters. Neither the environment nor the welfare of animals can sustain these farming practices, and they must be phased out.
In our next story, Country Life's Carol Stiles is heading to a sawmilling yard on the outskirts of Gisborne.
Quite often you can actually tell a timber by its smell. You know, poplar actually smells like sick. Totara does it a bit too. But timber like Lawsoniana, that's one of my favourite timbers. It's got a beautiful smell. You know, when I say to Nick, my mate over here, we're not going over to make timber, we're going over to cut sawdust. Yeah, if we're cutting sawdust, we're having fun, both of us.
For 31 years, John Larson has been making sawdust here at Makaraka. Over that time, though, the business has seen huge change. John says he'd now describe Larson Sawmilling as a rural merchandising company. He makes a lot of the products he sells right here. Milling timber may be the best part of the job, but John says it now makes up just a tiny portion of his work.
Very small. It's probably only 5% of our turnover.
What's the rest?
Selling posts and, like I'm leaning against, timber and fencing material and manufactured product like dog kennels and runs, farm gates, outside toilets, chook houses, barbecue tables, planters, compost bins.
You've diversified then?
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, matter of having to. It's cheaper for me to pick the phone up and buy exactly what I want from a number of sawmills or timber brokers around the country and get exactly what I want when I want it at the price I can sort of afford to pay and still make a twist out of it rather than do it myself. And the volumes that I'm selling, I could never produce. Never. Not in a month of Sundays.
So who gets you to mill their timber?
Oh, the odd cocky here and there that's still got a bit. We're currently milling quite a bit of poplar that's come off a station, and it'll be going back onto that station for cattle yards and sheep yards and gates and whatever else.
Because he could probably use pine cheaply.
No, but it didn't come off the farm.
And that matters?
Oh, yeah.
So you don't like milling pine?
No. Macrocarpa or redwood. Much more fun. Poplar's a challenge, and eucalypt is a bigger challenge again.
Why is that?
It just bends and twists and bows and buckles, and it's as heavy as hell. And, you know, I like something with a bit of challenge and a bit of character.
So tell me, how have you seen the sawmilling business change in the last 31 years?
Most mills have closed down. There's never been any money in sawmilling. That's probably why I don't do a lot of it. And so because there's no money in it, there's no money to spare for investment into better gear and to try and improve productivity. It's been all small sawmills, undercapitalised, and no future really.
Well, just out here at the port, there you see boats lining up to take the logs. What, to China, I guess?
Yeah, wherever, yeah.
Yeah.
They go over the sea somewhere, yeah, yeah.
What did you do when you left school?
I went to Massey, learned how to drink booze. Did a bit of fencing, did a bit of crutching, played a bit of rugby.
And you're still involved with rugby?
Yeah, very much so.
What do you do?
I am a major sponsor of one of the local rugby clubs, Ngātapa Rugby Club.
Go to every game?
Go to every game, go to every training on a Thursday night. Don't miss out. There's something wrong. If I can't get to training on Thursday night, I'll even ring the coach and say, hey, coach, I can't get here tonight. If I'm going to sponsor, I'm in boots and all.
What else do you sponsor?
I sponsor the RNP show. I sponsor the show jumping. And I've been doing that for 30 years. It's the Larson Sawmilling Equestrian Festival.
And people come from all around?
All over, yeah. I mean literally all over, because we've had teams here from Aussie. We've had people from Japan, New Caledonia, all over New Zealand, South Island. It's a very, very popular event. One of the majors on the show jumping program, apparently.
And the AMP show, that's a highlight of your year.
To my mind, it's the hardest 2 days' work of the year, because you see people in their good gears. I normally see people in their working gears and in their farm utes, etc. And all of a sudden they've come to town. They've got their wife with them. They've got a hat on that you don't recognise. They've got shades on that you don't recognise. And they just look completely different. And, it is a problem recognising them sometimes. You know, if I can't sort of recognise them and call them a name, bang on, well, it's g'day, mate, how you going, right? So, there's a fair bit of that at showtime.
Financially, is it worth it for you?
Put it this way. If I had to give up anything, the show would be the last thing I ever gave up. It can be very, very worthwhile.
So, are these your dog kennels?
These are dog kennels, yeah, two different sizes. Treble dog runs there. Down here we've got a quad. We've got an order for four of those. Yeah.
So that's for farm, and then they must have 16 dogs.
Yeah. Recently we did one for 22 dogs. So it was a truck and trailer load of dog runs went out.
There's still some pretty big properties out
there. There are in this region, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah,
Gisborne East Coast, Wairau. Yeah, there's some big properties still. A lot of dogs.
I can tell they're not for city dogs because they're not insulated.
Well, they've actually got a ply ceiling in them, so they are partially insulated. But every now and again, we do get requests from somebody that wants bats put in their dog kennel.
And you do that?
Yeah, we'll do that. Yeah. They got the money and we got the time. Give the customer what they want.
You know your logo?
Yeah.
It's got a hat on, very similar to one that you're wearing.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's not by accident.
Not by accident at all. Total by design. They were the old drover's hat.
Ah.
The reasonably low profile with a wider brim.
Where do you get those these days?
Very, very hard to come by.
You better buy a stash.
Yeah. I think the last one, one of the last ones I had was actually made by some outfit in Wellington. Yeah, but I always managed to wear it out in the peak, in the crown there. Putting it on an awful too often.
Doffing it.
Doffing it, exactly. Yeah. This is a chook house in the middle of construction.
What's this tall one over here?
It's a meat safe. So, that's for a cocky that wants to be able to hang his mutton or his dog tucker or whatever and do it properly. So it's all fly-proof screen around that. And it's even paw-proof, apparently.
Paw-proof?
Paw-proof from dogs trying to get up to get the dog tucker. There's your standard old long drop.
I guess people still need them, don't they?
Absolutely. You've got to go every day, so you've got to be comfortable when you're doing it. So, yeah, we sell a lot of dunnies. At one stage there, we just couldn't keep up with production of dunnies. We make them three at a time. They were going everywhere.
Mainly to farms?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, probably not. Farms is where you would think they are required, and they are, but they're also going into forestry situations now where logging contractors are getting them. And with more women working in the forestry industry, they require a better standard of toilet than what a lot of the fellas require. And they're going into the horticultural industry. A lot of people up the coast are buying them now when their whānau come home for Christmas, etc. And there's a big group. They don't want everybody inside using the water supply because most of it's on tank. So they get one of these and dig a hole in the backyard, and that's your patch. This is ours.
You'd think it was just a loo, but there's lots of design features, really, aren't there? There's plenty of ventilation.
Plenty of ventilation, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's plenty of room to put your papers while you're doing some bookwork.
Inside lock?
Yeah, there's the hook there, so you can lock yourself in.
How much does a dunny cost?
One of these, $880 plus just.
So you're pleased? You've made a career out of this?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah,
it's been a lot of fun. Working with timber, the people that, that I've made contact with, or made contact with me, the relationships that have developed. Yeah, business is all about relationships, eh?
Do you do a lot of the office work yourself?
No, I can't drive a computer. Not about to learn either. No, I hate the things. But I can see that they've made a significant difference to my life in the last 6 weeks, probably, since we've gone all computer.
Up to 6 weeks ago, you were...
I was writing every invoice every month. That was a full-time job. And then I did everything else over and above that. Because I just have a fear of computers. I can't even handle a cell phone. If I hear the call come, I can answer it. But if I don't hear it and somebody leaves an answer message or a message on the phone, I've got no idea how to recall it, how to get it back. Hopeless.
So what made you make the change?
One or two clients coming in, and this is where it comes down to relationships, saying, "Hey, John, why don't you send your blimmin' invoices out by email?" And, I'd never really thought about it. I've always done it this way. Snail mail, whatever they call it, yeah. Yeah, and it was costing us a fortune. You know, with stamps and envelopes and me writing time writing it out and the girls putting it on. I don't know what they did with it, but eventually we got paid. If we didn't get paid, I'd get on the blower and, what the hell's the problem? Come on, I'm not your bank. So, yeah, as I say, it's freed me up. Otherwise, I'd be very upset if I was standing here talking with you and not writing invoices, because that's what I would normally be doing.
You won't know yourself.
I will. Yeah, I will. Yeah, I can go and make some sawdust. Or go and treat some wood. I'll be able to have time for a beer every now and again. That'll be different.
John Larson ending that story. And he's also a sponsor of the Sunrise Foundation, a community foundation that gives grants to organisations in Tairawhiti. Last year, it supported 50 community groups.
Hi, I'm Richard Glenn from the Waikato. I'm a kiwifruit grower and I'm listening to Country Life on RNZ National.
Now in our feature story, we're at a farm on the West Otago-Central Otago border near Rays Junction. The 160-hectare property is owned by Stuart and Barb Peel. Stuart took over the farm when his parents Don and Janet retired. For years, Don ran a wool carding business from a shed on the farm, and after serving as his apprentice, Barb is now in charge of tally-ho wool carding. She showed Cosmo the oldest of their two huge carding machines.
This one is not working at the moment, just needs a bit of work on it. It's born in 1922 in Bradford, England. It's actually one of the biggest private carding machines in New Zealand. Most of the other ones are little half cards, but these are there's actually two machines here and they're both full cards. And they were bought into New Zealand by the woolen mills in Milton, and then they've sort of slowly progressed out of there when they didn't need them. This one here went down to Kennington, and it was in a guy's shed, and he was carding using it. And then Mr. and Mrs. Peel got hold of it, and they were offered it, and they brought it up here and started working it, but they only used to card greasy wool. That's why it's sort of gunged up a bit with grease. But it's done a lot of hours, but it still goes. You only have to push a button and it still goes. Mm. But it just needs a bit of work done to it.
What does carding actually do to the wool?
Carding only opens the fibres so that you can use them. When I say only opening the fibres, it's really important. You get a really tight little fibre, like this one. And you want to spin that. Now, that's rather difficult to spin. It's sort of all knotted together. This has been washed. Mm. So by the time you put it through the carding machine, it's like that.
So you make it light and fluffy.
It's like making clouds out of fleece wool. Then it's used for felting, spinning, stuffing, yoga bolsters, anything that you feel like using it for.
When you first came here, did you have an interest in wool?
Well, I met my husband on the internet 20 years ago, and when I came down here, I didn't even know what a hoggett was. I had no idea. I got my national diploma in ag and dairying, but I didn't even know what a hoggett was. So,
You came down from the North Island?
Yeah, yeah.
So you came in here and saw, I guess, Don and Janet working on these machines. Did a switch turn on?
Well, Don always said, he said, there's nobody to take it over. Okay, Stuart is here, but he's more interested in the farming side than the carding. Mm. I absolutely love the machine. My dad's an engineer, and so the maintenance, the keeping it going, that really interests me. I don't mind getting my hands dirty fixing things. It's a really easy machine to fix because you can generally pinpoint what's wrong because it's not computerised. So Don used to card the machine. He's coming up 85 this year. And when I came 20-odd years ago, he was sort of thinking, oh, well, what's going to happen to the carder? It's a dying art. And at that stage, the internet was coming on board and stuff like that. The business was going a little bit slower, but to be honest, it was probably because of older fashion marketing and stuff like that.
And synthetics perhaps coming in?
Yeah. The plastic society came in. You know, your average clothes you wear are made of petroleum-based products. And so, yeah, that came in. So then father was sort of saying, well, and I said to him one day, it was Mother's Day actually, and I said to him, oh, look, would you like me to help you with your business? And he says, oh, there's nothing you could do. It's a dying art. Mm. And I says, oh, no, well, I'll help you. So I have. And our product range, when I first came, I think we had maybe 15 lines, and now we've got over 80. So every year the business is just getting bigger and bigger and bigger. But sometimes you have to hold things at a limit because, you know, you don't want to sort of outdo yourself. So
as the wool carding business grows, it takes up more floor space in the shed. And this has become a bone of contention.
Well, the space has to be shared between me and my husband. There's a little bit of a battle goes on because his down this end is his workshop and he claims that his workshop should come to this pole here.
Ooh.
And that's his workshop.
You've taken over a lot of his territory.
Well, kind of. And then on this side's the carding, which you can see is full of carding. And then over here is the wool shed. Well, Stuart actually has to book the wool shed when he wants to use it.
Because at the moment it's full of fadges of what, coloured wool?
Coloured fleeces, yeah. These fleeces are all from our own sheep. a lot of the wool that we card and sell is our own product. So that's really important to us. That's why our prices are really quite cheap. So we're able, instead of passing being the producer, we're the producer, the manufacturer, and the point of sales to the customer. So because we can be all three, we managed to keep the price down. So, you know, it's really comparable where folk in New Zealand should start thinking about going to where the stuff is made.
And that adds a nice story to your products as well, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, most, you know, I can tell you where it comes from, and the sheep are ours. I actually buy the fleece wool off my husband. Yeah. I pay him 15 times more what the wool buyer will give him at the moment. but he also is quite well aware that if he doesn't keep his wool up to scratch, I won't buy it off him.
What micron wool is it?
Our Romney range is, we like to have it around 32 micron, which is a fairly fine Romney, but it's a softer craft wool. I've just bought in a ton of Merino, and that's 22 micron. But I also bought in half a ton of combed Merino, and that's 19 micron.
Balls of freshly carded, natural dyed and mixed wool are waiting to be picked up by a courier van. Barb has developed three selling streams for the Tallyho brand. One of them is a retail outlet.
We have Tallyho Wool Shop in Roxburgh on the main street there, and we sell it on Trade Me. And we have our own website, which is easily found, Tallyho Wool Carding.
Yes.
And we also card grandma's wool for her, or whoever has the odd sheep in the paddock and they want it carded. You know, everybody's important, from the nana who sends us half a kilo. We'll do it for her. That's not a problem. And yet we've just finished an order for another lady for 150 kilos. So it doesn't matter. It's actually the love of the fleece. It really doesn't have anything much to do with the money. Oh, that's important. It makes the world go past. But still, it's just enjoying and helping other people enjoy what they do.
The main carding machine that Barb uses is about as long and wide as a bus, and it's quite a sight to behold.
This one was born in Bradford, England in 1951, and he's got 37 different rollers on him. Now, with the 37 rollers, how it works is you're wanting the wool to be carried forward clockwise, but of the 37 rollers, 90% of them go anti-clockwise, so you've only got a few working ones. Now, in this actual machine, with the 37 rollers, there's actually only two rollers that touch. So there's no pressure put on it. So it's not, that's why it's lasted so long, because there's not a lot of pressure using it. The two rollers that touch, they sort of take it, pull it off, comb it off the other roller beside it. But the rest just carry it with a flicking motion. And that flicking motion is what Grandma used to use, by sitting there with the two hand carders and flicking backwards and forwards. So it's the same idea. It's the same principle as what Grandma did. But this one goes a lot quicker, and we self-feed it into one end.
Can you put one fleece through this machine?
Yes, of course you can. I can put 500 grams through the machine. But you don't, because it's such a small run, you don't necessarily get 500 grams out. But the machine looks after the wool. I'll turn it on and you can hear it. It's just speeding up now. I'll just put it on to full speed. Yesterday I had quite a big breakdown. One of these big leather belts, it snapped. These are the original leather belts from 1951. It actually rotted and split on the joiner. So one of my staff and I joined it yesterday. That will last probably another 30 years. So now I'll just show you a little bit what happens. You look at this little bit of brown wool. So I'll just pop that in there and you'll see it going up. There's different pitches of teeth all the way along. See, these are hard teeth, and the further you get, the teeth become softer. And there it goes, it's gone already.
The wool's being slowly sucked into the machine.
Yeah. It actually takes less than a minute to get from this end to the other end. So by the time we walk back down the side, you see the way the rollers are turning? See how most of them are going anti-clockwise?
Yeah.
If anybody's ever interested in coming and looking at it, I'm most happy to show them. This roller here is the one with the longest teeth on it. And that's one of the touching rollers. There's only two touching, that's one of them.
And what does it do when it touches the wall?
It's carrying it across that half of the machine into the other half. So there's the wall that I put in there. This lady here just sent 5 bags from the North Island, and she's just sent them in rubbish bags for us to cart.
And what will she do with that wool, do you think, once she gets it back?
I suspect she's going to spin it. Yeah. They do a variety of things. We supply a lot of Steiner schools around New Zealand. They use our wool because it's pure, and they use it for stuffing their Steiner dolls, kindergartens, felting courses. Yeah. We actually supply wool all around the world as well. We sell a lot that goes to Russia for felting in Russia.
How did you connect with people in Russia?
They kind of hunt you down. We've got 4 New Zealand Russian customers who we sell the wool to within New Zealand. And then it's after we sell it to them, then it's their problem what they do to it. But they send it to Russia. They love the New Zealand Merino, the coloured Merino. It's fairly hard to get. There's a few farmers around that we buy off. But, yeah, the Russians absolutely love that. We send wool to Japan, Australia. I've even sent wool to the North Pole.
So that sound you can hear is a balling machine that Barb has just turned on.
It takes the rovings off the machine, which is a big long sausage, and it puts it in here and rolls it into balls.
Yeah, so once it's balled, it's ready to go.
Yeah. This machine was also probably built around the same time as the big fella, so he's probably 70 years old. But we run him now by remote control.
The Tally-ho carding business employs several locals.
Half of them are on the pension, so we just top up their pay, their pension pay for them. But they're all very passionate about what they do. They all spin and they all weave as well. So if anybody ever rings and needs to know anything, one of my ladies will help them out. Mm. They're really good. You've got Marilyn. She does all the washing and dyeing. Then you've got Jen. She's my second on the carder. She cards as well. And then you've got Noel, who pops up every so often when she's not doing the fruit season. And then in the shop, we've got other support that help father out in the shop. I do the accounts and all that sort of stuff as well for the farm, the shop and the carding. And I try to do the maintenance, some of the maintenance that I can handle, but the rest Stuart does.
Do you think you will get a young apprentice in one day who would be keen to learn the ropes? Would you like that?
That would be wonderful. Yeah, yeah. If somebody wanted to come and learn how to do it and then take it over. You don't have to be young. Just somebody who is passionate about it. You know, new blood is always good. I mean, we've got 3 sons. None of them are particularly interested in it. One's a joiner. One has his own business with Hydrolink and the other one's a chef. The joiner has his own factory in Melbourne. You know, they know how to work. They're good boys.
But wool carding is not their passion.
No, no.
There'll be someone out there.
There might be. There might be. But the door is always open for somebody to come.
Stuart, were you brought up on this farm?
Yes, yep, all those many years ago, so I've seen all the changes.
Do you do most of the work on the farm or do you and Barb share the workload?
We share the workload. When the workload's quite heavy, then we share it. And if I go to work, I'll leave her a list for her to do in the afternoon if she's not riding her horse.
And you were off farm today, weren't you?
Yeah.
What were you doing?
I was vaccinating ewes over in my flat. Yeah, we had just over 3,000 ewes to vaccinate and drench, and yeah.
And when did your dad first get into carding?
I was about 15 when he started that. He was running a few coloured ewes for mother for his spinning, and then the flock grew, and he thought, well, what the hell do I do with the wool? So they started carding it and selling it to other people, and yeah, just grew from about 6 sheep up to 300 coloured ewes.
How did he get those huge carding machines up here?
They were trucked in, and the end wall of the shed was taken off, and then we had a forklift, two forklifts, one on each side, and sort of quietly jiggled them in, and yeah, it was a mission in itself, but I wasn't here to see it, thank goodness.
Yeah, and I guess they haven't moved ever since?
No, I helped with the newer machine, and we had a telehandler lift that in, but we had to sort of sneak up the side of the shed and then go in the workshop. Yeah, it took us about a month nearly to pull the machine to bits in Milton and then get it up here and put it all back together and get it running, and yeah.
Another large shed in the farmyard is home to a custom-built wind dryer.
It's a very economic way of drying wool because it doesn't use any heat. When you dry wool with heat, especially even in the sun, it goes all crispy and crunchy. So by drying it just with wind, it stays more in its natural state than drying out. This is a customer's wool here.
So
these are three different lots.
How long does it take to dry the wool?
We can fit 14 kilos on this rack, and it depends on what the weather's doing outside. If it's a nice day outside, like today, it sucks in the warm air and it comes through. So generally 24 hours,
so not too long.
Yeah, and because it doesn't use heat, it means it's quite economical to use. But this was built because we used to have beds, all these old wire wove beds all around the place, and the wool had to be hand turned over and taken outside and inside, and it was just a nightmare. So we decided we needed something different. We tried a lot of different things, but then Stuart came across this accidentally on the internet, and the original prototype for it was a horse walking in circles to use the motor. So I said that was brilliant, and I congratulated him. He didn't actually even know he'd done it, but I congratulated him, and I got a builder in, and I showed the builder, and he said, we can do that. And within 24 hours, we had it built, and it's the best thing we've ever built. So it was only a matter of adapting something that was medieval into modern times. Even my wheelbarrow is Kiwi Initiative. This is when I'm carting milk for my calves, so I don't tip it over.
Nice.
So this is where the wool is washed, not scoured. This is where we wash wool. It's multi-purpose. We also milk the cows here.
You're not a big fan of scouring.
Scouring is using fairly hard chemicals. We do have our bulk wool scoured. That's okay, but I don't mind it, but I prefer just something a little bit naturaler.
Is it a pretty straightforward process?
Using dishwash detergent and soda crystals. Yeah, and hot water, very hot water. It's a myth thinking that you need to wash wool in warm water. From its raw state, you know, I wouldn't go washing a woolen jersey in hot water, but the water's the hottest we can get it. So, yeah, so it works for us. And in the morning, this is the first thing I do, is in here milking the cows.
How many cows do you milk a day?
We milk three, and that's because they're designed to be milked, not feed calves, because they're dairy cows. So we feed five calves per cow.
Because three cows would give you quite a bit of milk.
I'm getting 60 litres a day at the moment. Yeah. So rare food calves. I'm doing 40 this year. 30 are already contract sold. I only feed them milk till Christmas time, and then after Christmas I carry on milking the cows, because then what I do is I rear pigs. And my pigs are solely milk fed. And I do three a year, because it takes three to get one whole complete in my freezer for nothing, because I sell two, and then it puts the other one in our freezer for nothing.
Your freezer must be chocker.
We have beef, pork,
mutton, lamb, yeah. The only thing we don't do is the chickens, because, I mean, obviously, an egg-laying chicken's not meant for meat. I just can't bring myself to eat my chickens or my ducks.
You were telling me just before that the ducks do two very important jobs on the farm.
Yeah, the ducks, below our house we've got a big pond, and the pond is a spring-fed and it's not a flowing pond, so it should be a breeding ground for mosquitoes and bugs and things like that. But we're very fortunate because the ducks eat them all on the top, so they keep the bugs off there. And they also keep the codlin moth larvae, they eat that from around the bottom of our apple trees. Stuart, many years ago, he grafted all our trees. We've got 70 different varieties of the old English apples, and they're well sought after. We've been asked many times, but we actually lost the paperwork with the names on them, and the only way we can tell which apples are which is when they have apples on them. But there's 70 different varieties of apples that Stuart's grafted himself from all around New Zealand.
Barb Peel ending that story. Cosmo was also talking to Stuart Peel at their farm near Rays Junction. And that's it for this week. But before we go, a huge congratulations to Sally Round, who took out the top award at the Guild of Agricultural Journalists and Communicators last Friday night for the series she produced with a Wairarapa winemaker.
Gotta catch the bus. Bye now.
Bye.